Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with John McGill about his new book, The Incomparable Magazine Street. We'll also hear from David Cuthbert and Bob Bruce, who've adapted their musical show, Cinderella Battistella, into a children's book. And I'll have a review of Desmond Ward's Sing, Unburied, Sing. John McGill may have retired as senior curator of the historic New Orleans collection, but that doesn't mean he stopped working. Today, we'll be talking about his grand new book, The Incomparable Magazine Street, with photographs by Margot Landon. It's a loving history of one of our city's favorite streets and one of its most diverse. John McGill, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, this is the perfect book for you because my most enduring and endearing image of you is driving back from Audubon Park with my dog in the car and seeing you waiting for the Magazine Street bus.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been closely observing Magazine Street for as long as I can remember.
I have, although I wasn't brought up in New Orleans, but I've lived on Magazine Street, rather off it, on either Constance or Camp Street since 1974. So I've seen changes up in the vicinity. You know, when I first moved up there, just around the corner from the Arabella Bus Barn, which is now Whole Foods.
Right.
And the greenery was still in operation in those days at the corner of Octavia Street, where Toulouse, the famous Pyrenees, used to sleep in front of the front door back in those days of the 70s when everyone wanted to get rid of furniture and fill their houses with plants.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Then diagonally across the street, there was Mr. Ott, the pet store. And I heard tales from people who've lived in the neighborhood a lot longer than I have when they were children back in the 50s. They would collect lizards and sell them for a nickel to Mr. Ott, who would turn around and sell them for 50 cents or 75 cents.
Profit margin in lizards.
Profit margin in lizards, yes.
And Boku Books was on Magazine Street.
Boku Books was on Magazine Street. And where CC's is located in that gorgeous 1900 Queen Anne building was DuPont's Pharmacy.
Right.
And that building had been a pharmacy from the time it opened until the late 1980s when DuPont's became Uptown Delivery Pharmacy and they moved over to the corner of Nashville.
Right.
And they've been there ever since. And of course, one of my favorite places was, well, today it's British Antiques, but I remember when it was Dionysian Bar, where I went once for 10 minutes and decided that was enough. But
maybe every building on Magazine Street was once a bar, but no.
That's the interesting thing, because what I ran across were tons of cobblers, shoe repair shops. Today, there are only like three or four left, and they're all within about two or three blocks of each other on the street. But you had cobblers every few blocks, in some cases, several in a block. I remember between Nashville and Arabella, there was one shoe repair store on the riverside of the street. Then across the street in the garage, where is the kitchen now for Chez New, there was another shoe repair shop there. And they were virtually all Italian, which I thought was very, very interesting. And of course, it's logical. Many of these folks were immigrants who were coming over beginning 1880s, 90s, early 20th century. And of course, where are some of the finest shoes in the world made?
Italy.
Ferragamo, Bruno Mali, and all that. So, of course, they would bring their trades and their talents with them. Actually, it's interesting how the stores have changed along Magazine Street. Sort of the focal point of the opening of the book was the 1948 M Day, when the street was repaved, was asphalted, the streetcar tracks were torn up. It took only 6 months to do that, too. And a trolley buses or trolley coaches or electric buses, whatever you want to call them, were put up along the street. And they had a big event that day to encourage people to come into Magazine Street and go to the four shopping districts regional and sort of start as a regional shopping area. There were lots of bars along the street. Corona's was in the 2000 block, and you can still see the name in tile in front of their location. actually the oldest still family-owned business in the same location on Magazine Street is Henry's Bar.
Oh, yes. That's been around. Serving beer since before you were born.
Since before you were born. An Irish immigrant, I believe his last name was Lee, bought a saloon on the corner where it is today in 1900, an existing established saloon at that time in the same building. And it's gone through the same family, through son-in-laws over the years. It was called Crone's Bar for a number of years. And then people called it Henry's when Henry Grogreave was the owner. And then ultimately it was just officially changed to Henry's Bar. And of course, it's probably one of the most historically, shall we say, infamous spots on Magazine. Because
right.
Lee Harvey Oswald, who lived at 4905 Magazine, would frequent the bar. But he wasn't a big drinker. I don't think he had enough money to really buy drinks. He'd go to the family grocery store, which was right next door, and he'd check out the prices and go home and tell his wife, and she'd go back and and buy meat or whatever from the store. But he'd watch the television at the bar.
Now, one of the things you talk about in this book, and, you know, it's so much fun to read about that celebration in 1948, MJ, is how our perceptions of Magazine Street have changed over the years. Because for a long time, people thought the end of it was fairly countrified.
Uh-huh.
And that wasn't their great urban center.
Well, you know, it was basically regional shopping areas. In 1948, by then, it evolved into four shopping districts.
Four public markets.
Right, four public markets. And that's how many of the business areas in New Orleans, not just Magazine Street, but you go over to Dryades, which is now Aretha Castle Haley.
Yes.
That was Dryades Market. You go down to St. Claude, St. Rock Market. But Magazine Street tended to maintain those shopping areas. And by 1948, there were four separate business groups. One was serving the Magazine Street Market, which dated to the 1850s, and that's where Sophie Wright Place is today, and it's now sort of an events center. And then you go farther up, you have the 9th Street Market, which was a sort of a decorating shop for a number of years and just has reopened as a jewelry store. And then you go further up, you have the Jefferson Market, which was where the St. George's School gym is today. And then you go farther up to the Ewing Market at the corner of Joseph Street, which is now a very elegant, very upscale ladies' store. But as those markets were built, they became the anchors, sort of like department stores were the anchors to the shopping malls back in the shopping mall days, you know, Holmes, Maison Blanche, Sears, whatever. So as soon as a market opened, other businesses would come in. And these were frequently not always upscale businesses. They were frequently, you know, banks, insurance companies, bars, barber shops, hairdressers, businesses that would serve daily life. But sometimes you would get some upscale development in there. Actually, some very upscale stores developed in that area between Felicity and Jackson Avenue. One of them, for those who remember Krieger's, mm-hmm. Women's Star on Canal Street. Well, they started in that part of Magazine Street. There were some very expensive grocery stores. These were not the markets. These were grocery stores that served the Lower Garden District and the Garden District. But these were definitely neighborhood shopping areas, walk-to shopping areas, sort of what modern urban developers say we should be doing, biking and walking to the stores we need to go to. And that's what these were all about. And they would go up and they would go down. You know, there were times when Magazine Street really had collapsed. The area between Felicity and Jackson had pretty much closed storefronts just 20 years ago and has since, you know, really come back into its own. But these were neighborhood shopping areas. These were great areas as urban planners would see them. And of course, as time has gone by, more and more of the residential areas have become commercial. And there are some parts of Magazine you can go along and you see one double house after another, sometimes fairly big houses like where WRBH is located. It's a big mansion in its day. And, you know, here you have these housing buildings that have been converted into commercial.
So one of the things that I love about this book is that you find these great characters. I mean, they're great New Orleans characters, but it's almost as if there's a subset of Magazine Street characters.
Yeah, well, in some respects, we just stumbled across them. Uh-huh. You know, one lady we stumbled across, she was sitting on her front porch, and she was one of the first African-American families in that particular part of Magazine Street. And she had some great stories to tell, and she moved up there in 1970. Other areas, as you get closer to Felicity, some people who are, especially from Italian families, who remember the area when they were being brought up there in the 1950s. And one person says, what is all this Lower Garden District? We're the Irish Channel.
Well, and you catch up with people like Brian Batt.
Yes.
Who's really made a splash on Magazine Street.
And there are others like, you know, Aidan Gill and Katrina Greer, who have just, you know, really done so well along the street. And when you look at the histories of the businesses that have been in there, in their spots, like Mrs. Greer's shop, the French Library. When you go back to the 1940s, that was a plumbing establishment.
And now it's one of the most beautiful bookstores in the city.
And very, very, I hate to use the word unique, but it really is.
It is.
You have to go a long way to find a store like that. And I think that's what really pulls people to Magazine Street. Because although there are a few upscale chain stores like Lush, which is an international company,
of course,
opened on Magazine Street, most of these are one of a kind. And so they bring clientele in not just from, say, the South Shore, but from the North Shore and from other parts of the South as well, and the whole street is like that. And so many of the people I talked with said, you know, people just come along here. You know, visitors will come in and into the store. They'll just kind of stumble in and have a wonderful time.
And it's great to have a bookstore on Magazine Street, mm-hmm. because I used to think of it as Boku Books, George Hergett's books.
Uh-huh.
You know, Afro-American Bookstop uh-huh. was on Magazine for uh-huh. a while. I used to think of it as a bookish street.
Yeah.
So now we have French Library and Octavia Books just
well, you
off
know,
it.
Things have become very much more fashion-oriented, you
yes.
know. And when you consider, you know, you have the one bookstore on Magazine Street, it is very specialized to very elegant French
yes.
merchandise. And if you walk around that particular part of the neighborhood, it has become more French. There are several other shops in the vicinity
right.
that have great French influence.
Mm-hmm. Now, Magazine Street also occupies a special place in our civic celebrations. That M Day was a really remarkable celebration,
yes.
but now
it has become Mardi Gras.
Yes.
And you know, what's interesting about Magazine Street is that the first modern carnival parade, the Mystic Crew of Comus, started at the intersection of Magazine and Julia. Of course, there's no Mardi Gras celebration around there. Now you have to go down to St. Charles to get that. But Toth was the first of the Magazine Street parades. And it was kind of a neighborhood parade, the parade of the shut-ins. And it would you know, go by Children's Hospital. And I think there used to be a Hospital of the Incurables and the Poydras Home. And there were several orphanages along the street.
Right.
The Protestant Orphanage, which I found out was originally called St. John's Protestant Orphanage, but it dropped to St. John's after a while. The St. Vincent's Infant mm-hmm. Home. And so the parade made a point of visiting those particular institutions. And of course, it has just grown and grown and grown over the years. I think it started with something like five floats in 1947, may have been a few more than that, but it was a relatively small parade. But, you know, now that the parades are in Orleans Parish, except for Endymion, are being concentrated on St. Charles Avenue, they're starting on Magazine. Of course, they used to start at Napoleon and Magazine. Now they're starting more and more at the intersection of Jefferson and Magazine. So you get Magazine in there as well, which, you know, living up in that neighborhood, I think that's the greatest place.
So now we both get to live right off a parade route.
Right off parade route. And I have friends on Magazine Street I can go and visit.
You have a lot of friends on Magazine Street after this book, John. I know you do. Oh, we've been talking with John McGill about his wonderful new book, The Incomparable Magazine Street, with photography by Margot Landon. You can meet them Tuesday, October 17th at 6 p.m. at the Historic New Orleans Collection, or Thursday, October 19th at Octavia Books. John, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed writing the book and I enjoyed this today. Thanks so much.
I am so happy to welcome David Cuthbert and Bob Bruce to The Reading Life. David wrote for the Times-Picayune for 43 years, most of them as a theater critic, and he's collaborated with Bob Bruce ever since the 1970s. Bob worked as a costume designer for Nord's Ty Tracy Theater for 32 years. Together, they turned their talents to a musical, Cinderella Battistella, which has now become a book illustrated by Herb Lennart. David, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hey, it's great to see you again.
You too, Bob.
Thank you.
So this is a New Orleans book, through and through.
Exactly.
Just like both of you are.
I mean,
So what were some of the things that went into putting a New Orleans, you know, gloss on this great fairy tale?
Well, we did some other musicals, most infamously, Lemura of the Islands and Lemura and the Curse of the Voodoo Queen, which ran for a year, which that was a takeoff of Dorothy Lemure musicals set in the South Seas, somewhere north of the Industrial Canal. And so we love this form, and we love taking something that was extant, that was there, and adding a New Orleans patois and references to it. And this is my favorite fairy tale. And there are so many versions of Cinderella. When I went to look, I found things that you wouldn't believe. Okay, just a couple. The Penguin Cinderella is not from the Penguin. All the characters are penguins. Bigfoot Cinderella. Cinderella's Sisters, A Revisionist Guide to Foot Binding. Interstellar Cinderella. Cinderella, as if you already didn't know the story. And my favorite, seriously, Cinderella is so annoying, the other side of the story.
Oh, wow.
So we thought they could stand another one.
So what about you, Bob? Did you go along for the ride, or is this one of your favorite stories, too?
I enjoyed it, but we had just done Silver Scream with Freddie. And we said, Freddie, we need to do another show, preferably a children's show, because they were looking for something at Le Petit. And he said, well, you have to make it New Orleans. That's what sells.
It's true. And, you know, it seemed natural for this to be a New Orleans story because you got your balls, your ball gowns, your dirty houses, which, you know, not like mine.
Poor little Cinderella lives in a ramshackle house, Camelback, on the wrong side of Esplanade. This is the 1950s. We set it in the 1950s because Bob and I were both teenagers then, and that was a magical time for us. And everything that wasn't there no more was there. And we just had fun with it, kidding it, and there are anachronisms in it, too. We just love taking something like the Twelfth Night Ball and making the cake with the bean in it and making it a king cake. The fairy godmother, Mother LaRue, is our voodoo fairy godmother, and she's Cinderella's fairy godmother because Mother LaRue lives in Algiers, and Cinderella lives in New Orleans, and Mother LaRue has to take the ferry to get to see Cinderella.
And that's a fairy godmother.
Right.
So, Bob, give us a little taste of how Mother LaRue talks when she talks.
Okay, let's see. Making magic's easy to do when you learn to cook with Mother LaRue. Throw in plenty of spice, add some red beans and rice. A little hocus pocus makes everything nice.
Sweet. That's a very New Orleans thing. Yes, red beans and rice with your hocus pocus. Now, you know, it is such a natural, not to mention the shoe fetish we all have now that we live
here. You know, that's interesting because in our version, the first three movies my mother took me to see were The Wizard of Oz, The Red Shoes, and Cinderella. And when I told Michael Musto, who was then the columnist for the late lamented Village Voice, that, he said, David, do you realize all three of those movies are about shoes?
They were.
I said, well, my mother did love shoes. And but it's my favorite fairy tale. I just loved it. Like, we needed gowns for the ball. Becky Allen played one of the sisters, Tangia Pahoa. Becky has never knowingly thrown away a piece of clothing. Becky came in with armfuls of gowns. My son worked the lights, and I worked beside him with a foul spot. So everybody was pressed into service. That was one of the happiest times of my life working on that show. And it's been done a lot, maybe more than our other shows.
More than any of our shows.
We've written 15 musicals.
And even the list in the back of the book that lists all the places that it played, I'd forgotten two.
Okay. Oh, how funny. So what was it like to turn it into a book? Did you have to do some thinking about it?
They called us. We each got an email saying that Pelican Press has a series of Cinderella books, and someone had recommended us because of the show. And so we went over there and met with them, and they gave us what they wanted, and we gave them what they wanted, and here we are.
That was 3 years ago.
Yes.
And at that time, that year, Cinderella Battistella played in three different theaters. Lockport, Louisiana, at Perry Martin's Bayou Theater, where they used some Cajun French for Mother LaRue, and the Rivertown Repertory Theater. And what was the third one?
I think the third one was Jesuit High School in January.
Okay. And so it was in the news, and it got some press, and that's how they heard about it. And we were notorious for a few seconds there. And But it was interesting because we had to condense. We had to do some rewriting. Mostly Bob did the rewriting. We had to just make it not for the stage, but for the page. But we never stop and think. Some people second-guessed us now and said, well, the kids, they're not going to know what some of this stuff is. I said, well, we set them up for that when we say, this story is set in 1950s New Orleans, when dinosaurs like your Meemaw and your Pawpaw roam the earth.
I love that.
I think that any parent or grandparent sitting down reading this book can explain to the child. I did to one of my youngest granddaughter. And if not, those kids can go and Google anything they want.
Oh, right.
You know, they can find out. They just head to their phones or the computer and their tablets and find out anything they want to.
Well, I have to say, I thought it was quite charming. The Prince Charming resembled Elvis a bit.
You want to tell her about
purpose,
that?
Yes.
Of course. When
the first time we were doing the show at Le Petit, Robert Lee, who played Harv Jr., all of a sudden, in the middle of the opening of his number, grabbed a rolling pin and held it like a microphone and started doing Elvis and the song that he was singing. So we kept that in. We always keep in anything that somebody throws in that's
Everybody
good.
Everybody contributes to stage shows. The actors contribute some wonderful things. The directors, of course, contribute wonderful things. Basically, we're told to shut up. We learned that our first show when Cass was getting notes from Ty and Bob and myself, and one actress, Glenda Guillory, said, who are we supposed to listen to? The director. So from then on, we filtered our comments through him.
Well, now you'll have an audience of small fry, hopefully, who will listen to you. And
the illustrations by Herb are so wonderful. Herb is very car conscious, too.
Yes, he is.
When Mother LaRue turns an eggplant into a purple Cadillac limousine, I believe it's a 1959 Cadillac limousine because I recognize those taillights immediately. And he really got hung up on that car because you see it a lot.
It's perfect.
There it is.
I would like that car. Well, we all need Mother LaRue as a fairy godmother, I think. And this is a treat for kids of all ages, as you know. We've been talking with David Cuthbert and Bob Bruce, who are the co-creators of Cinderella Battistella, A New Orleans Tale for Children of All Ages. You can meet them Saturday, October 14th at 11:30 at Barnes & Noble in Metairie, or Saturday, October 21st at noon at Barnes & Noble in Mandeville. David, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. You're so easy to talk with, Susan. You always have been. And when you bring me a book to review, you'd say, I'd say, when do you need this? And you'd say, oh, yesterday. And I'd say, okay, I'll do my best.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Jasmine Ward has become the supreme conjurer of contemporary American fiction. In her most recent novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, Ward takes us into the life of a complicated Mississippi family, struggling with loss, hoping for a kind of wholeness in a broken world. The novel begins on young JoJo's 13th birthday. He has determined to prove himself a man, and that is what he becomes in this book, reckoning with the release of his white father from prison, his black mother's struggle with addiction, the loss of his uncle to racial violence, the sickness of his grandmother, and the loving and incessant demands of his baby sister Kayla. JoJo is the most recent in one of Ward's portraits of wise beyond their years, struggling children. How to meet the great world when you are so small and it is so large and ferocious. At first, this seems a road novel as JoJo and Kayla accompany their mother and her friend Misty on a journey to bring his father home from Parchman Prison. But it becomes a journey that halts and starts, with stops for gas and drugs and drinks and drugs and a harrowing police stop. And finally, there will be a return home to Michael's parents, who have never welcomed Leonie and her children. But the larger context of this beautiful novel is the cost of the past and its buried secrets. As his grandfather Pop tells Jojo a story of a young boy he knew during his time at Parchman, he is giving Jojo a ghost companion, just as Leonie sees her brother Given, ghostly and present in her life as Mam, the matriarch, makes her peace with this world and prepares to move on to the next. This novel blazes with poetic language, making the most quotidian experience remarkable. Here is how Ward describes Jojo's longing to see birds in flight when the family arrives at the prison. But by the time we get out of the car in the parking lot, the birds have turned north, fluttered over the horizon. I hear the tail end of their chatter, of all those voices calling at once, and I wish I could feel their excitement, feel the joy of the rising, the swinging into the blue, the great flight, the return home. But all I feel is a solid ball of something in my gut, heavy as the head of a hammer. How we want this young boy to feel his rightful ease, how we want this family to be made whole. That is Jessamine Ward's gift, to instill in us that powerful longing, to light up the darkness of the past, so we can reconcile ourselves to it and come into the light and find home. This is awe-inspiring literary magic. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jessamine Ward discusses and signs Sing, Unburied Sing, Tuesday, October 10th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, October 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Christopher Swan reads from and signs Shadow of the Swan, Tuesday, October 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Edward Branley signs Krause, the New Orleans Value Store, Wednesday, October 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Günter Bischoff, Hans Pesgar, and Ambassador Wolfgang Petritisch present the Marshall Plan since 1947, Saving Europe, Rebuilding Austria, Thursday, October 12th, from 5 to 7:30 at the Louisiana Memorial Pavilion at the National World War II Museum. The Maple and Ladder Book Club discusses Walker Percy's Love in the Ruins, Thursday, October 12th at 6 at Ladder Library. Brian J. Costello discusses and signs Carnival in Louisiana, Thursday, October 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guests, David Cuthbert and Bob Bruce, signed Cinderella Battistella Saturday, October 14th at 11:30 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Novelist Morgan Babst discusses and signs The Floating World, Tuesday, October 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, John McGill, signs The Incomparable Magazine Street, Thursday, October 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Library hold their big book sale October 19th through 22nd. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, October 19th through 21st, from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Sunday, October 22nd, from noon to 5. That's at the Pontchartrain Center on Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Dates to mark on your calendar now. The Louisiana Book Festival takes place Saturday, October 28th on the grounds of the state capitol in Baton Rouge. Check out their website, louisianabookfestival.org, for information about the workshops taught by visiting writers Jocelyn Jackson, Michael Ferris Smith, Beth Ann Fennelly, Kathy Murphy, and Jeff Center. Those are Friday, October 27th. The New Orleans Book Festival takes place Saturday, November 11th in City Park. Coming up, Garden District Bookshop presents novelist Isabella Allende, discussing her book In the Midst of Winter with Anne Gislason. That's November 17th at 6 at the Academy of the Sacred Heart NIMS Fine Arts Center. This is a ticketed event. Go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com for information. The National World War II Museum presents the 10th Annual International Conference on World War II, November 16th through 18th at the museum, with 3 full days of internationally known writers. For more information, go to www.conference.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.